WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
There is a line in our time, and in every time, between those who believe that all men are created equal and those who believe that some men and women and children are expendable in the pursuit of power. There is a line in our time and in every time between the defenders of human liberty and those who seek to master the minds and souls of others. Those words were spoken by George W. Bush on September 11th during a speech given on Ellis Island in New York City. Those words should have been spoken about Bush, who was presiding over a project begun two decades ago, the removal of what has been termed excess democracy, in order to create an empire capable of subduing the planet and delivering its riches into the hands of a few. The people involved now are the same ones involved then. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The clash between democracy and empire in the U.S. has a long history, and a telling of that history clarifies the real goals of the policies perpetrated under the rubric of defense against terrorism. We'll look at that history tonight with author and teacher Michael Novick.
There's not a writer from the east to the west.
I did want to talk some about the whole question of U.S. imperialism and its relevance and history at this moment. I think it's a very pressing moment, obviously, in our history.
Michael Novick is one of the founders of the Anti-Racist Action Network, the author of White Lies, White Power, and the publisher of Turning the Tide, a journal that focuses on issues of colonialism, racism, and neo-fascism. He was interviewed recently by Casey Calloway and Stephen Starr of the Los Angeles Independent Media Center.
Really, the perspective I try to take about it is that history has represented choices that people made at many significant moments, and that we're making choices today, and that history is not just a burden that sits on people's shoulders, but history is something that people do make through their actions, through their efforts, through their choices. And if we look at some of the history and the efforts that people have made in the past to change the history of this country or shape the history of this country, I think that we have to understand the importance of questions of colonialism and questions of imperialism throughout our history. A lot of people have been very concerned about the war, about the repression that's happening in this country, thousands of people being interrogated, over 1,000 people more or less disappeared by the U.S. government off the map, their locations, in some cases secret, their identities secret. And I think one of the things important to understand is that those are not two separate problems, that the question of the war is not a question of foreign policy and the question of repression a question of domestic policy, but that they're both manifestations and symptoms of a systematic way that this country has operated from its founding, and a way in which people have either collaborated with or resisted those operations. And, you know, I think there have been some significant moments. You heard me speak the other night at Occidental College, where there was a teach-in on the question of the war. And as it went on, I felt that it was really important to address some of these issues, because it has an impact on what we do today and how we go about trying to deal with the situation facing us. And if we look at how deeply rooted and how systematic it is, but also, in a sense, how fragile that imperialist consensus can be in this country, that there have been moments when it was up for grabs as to whether and how, along what track we would proceed. And this could be another one of those moments, and we have to look at how we can affect it. What I related to people at the teach-in was to look back, for example, about 100 years at the Spanish-American War. And a lot of people tend to date imperialism from that period, and I'll begin there, although I want to look back deeper and further. But 1898, the United States was an advancing power in the world, was beginning to develop a marine presence, naval presence in various quarters of the world, pretty well consolidated its control over the continent. And Spain at that time was a failing imperial power, more or less decrepit, the fragments of its empire being contested by the people who were colonized within it. For example, Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines were some of the last remnants of the Spanish Empire at that time. And in all of those countries, the indigenous population or the settled population in some cases were people who wanted to break free of Spanish domination. The United States presented itself at that time as a liberator, and they announced that they were going to support the Cubans or support the Filipinos in a struggle against Spanish imperialism, and presented themselves as if they had no imperial ambitions of their own. But many people recognized in this country that, in fact, the drive towards war was an imperial drive, that there was an interest in conquest and in capturing those territories from Spain. And that was one of the early kind of inter-imperialist rivalries that people sometimes talk about, was between the dying Spanish Empire and the rising American Empire. And so in this country at that time, there was a strong anti-imperialist movement. Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, other leading educators and cultural, political figures formed something called the United States Anti-Imperialist League, which put forward the thesis that an insular empire, that is to say an empire of colonies on islands around the world, was inconsistent with a domestic republic. And that was a fatal error. They didn't recognize the nature of imperialism already built into the so-called republic. And so in that context, in which the forces opposing it were not able to get a handle on what they were actually dealing with, we saw in microcosm certain things that have become very, very familiar to us. For example, the so-called yellow press, the Hearst newspapers, began to boost their circulation by fomenting and agitating for war with Spain. The whole racist rationale of the kind of white man's burden was put forward, that Americans had an obligation to bring the blessings of the American way of life to what were actually referred to as our little brown brothers in the Philippines. And there was a pretext created for the war. There was a mysterious explosion aboard the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor. I believe ultimate historical evidence seems to say that it was either an accident or possibly something that was self-inflicted, but certainly no evidence whatsoever that the Spanish, either in Cuba itself at that time or from the imperial forces, had bombed a U.S. battleship. But that became the pretext that we were under attack. We had been victimized by the Spanish Empire. And so the United States was then justified in declaring war on Spain. And although it's called the Spanish-American War, it wasn't fought, obviously, in the United States, but it wasn't fought in Spain either. It was fought entirely in the colonies, in Puerto Rico, in Cuba, in the Philippines, which were societies that had indigenous movements of resistance. Puerto Rico and Cuba had been more or less jointly fighting for more than 30 years against the Spanish Empire. Cuba at that time had basically essentially achieved independence through, or was on the verge of doing it through, a process of armed struggle. And Puerto Rico had been granted autonomy by the Spanish crown and won an agreement from Spain that no changes would be made in its status without the consent and approval of the Puerto Rican population itself. And in the Philippines, a similar struggle was going on, basically a guerrilla movement of the Filipinos against the Spanish Empire. and the Spanish crown. And so the United States sent its naval forces steaming into these various harbors and areas, and landed troops engaged in some battles with garrisons of Spanish troops that had basically already been practically defeated by the local uprisings, and announced that we were riding to the rescue. Teddy Roosevelt, at that time prior to his presidency, pulled together this force of people called the Rough Riders, and you know, later rode into the presidency really on the reputation of being the man who went up San Juan Hill and, you know, created that sort of tough guy image that served him quite well as somebody who had come from an urban background but, you know, became rooted in the American West and was now, you know, carrying out that sort of martial responsibility of imperialism. And so you can see a lot of the things that shaped the politics of the 20th century in the kernel of that war, which did launch the United States on a path towards a global empire. In the same period of time, the U.S. Also carried out in Hawaii, which was not a colony of anybody. Hawaii was an independent monarchy ruled by the Hawaiians themselves with a local government that was recognized by, at that time, about 30 nations, which was most of the countries that probably existed in the world. They were you know, exchanging, you know, ambassadorial rank people between the Hawaiian monarchy and the British monarchy and the U.S. government. But in this period of imperial ambition, the United States began to settle people in Hawaii, originally with the approval and acceptance of the Hawaiians as people who could help develop Hawaii and promote its resources. And so these were people began to create plantations in Hawaii, and we know some of the names: Dole, not the Dole of the presidency, but the Dole of the pineapple, and you know, Christian missionaries who saw, you know, more money to be made in merchandising other things than the Bible, and they began to agitate for independence and for republicanism against the Hawaiian monarchy in this exact same period. And so in the same time frame that the United States was trying to carry out these so-called liberations of Cuba and the Philippines, they were in the process of promoting, and under the backing of the U.S. Marines, did allow the settlers and plantation owners in Hawaii to declare a new Hawaiian government to overthrow the monarchy and to declare that they were an independent and sovereign republican form of government, so-called. The Queen of Hawaii, Liliuokalani, abdicated the throne under protest, basically in the face of the presence of U.S. Marines and the backing of the U.S. military for the Hawaiian plantation owners, and specifically declared that she was only doing so under protest and that she awaited the conscience of the American people to reverse what was happening in her country. And very interestingly, people balked at it in the same way that there was a great deal of opposition to the Spanish-American War in the same period, when the question of accepting the petition of these Hawaiian plantation owners to be annexed by the United States, because that's what they did once they declared a republic against the monarchy. They immediately petitioned the United States government to be accepted as a territory. The Hawaiians themselves launched a petition drive in Hawaii, and basically almost everyone in Hawaii, with the exception of the plantation owners, signed this petition protesting the idea of annexation, urging the United States government to reject the call for annexation. The president at the time brought a bill before Congress. It was because it was a matter of international relations, since Hawaii, by any measure, was independent, whether you recognize the monarchy or this so-called plantation owners' republic. It was a separate country. And the Hawaiians, as I say, brought a petition to Congress saying, please reject this treaty, because it was a treaty between the two countries to annex Hawaii to the United States. And the treaty was, in fact, defeated. The one of the few times in U.S. history when the Senate refused to give its advice and consent to an international treaty was the treaty to annex Hawaii. About the only other time of major note was the refusal to endorse the League of Nations, you know, the generation later. And so the following year, having been rejected by the constitutional method, the president introduced a new resolution. There was a joint resolution to the House and Senate to annex Hawaii outside of the normal constitutional provisions. And it was adopted by a simple majority vote, which a treaty would have required a larger majority, which it failed to get. And so we did annex Hawaii in defiance of our own constitution. And I think this is a measure, again, of the question that these issues have been in struggle. And these were very, very sharp struggles 100 years ago, in which very often the popular will was thwarted, and popular antagonism to the idea of empire was suppressed by people with stronger economic interests and able to shape what direction events took, even if it contravened the law. In the same period, again, once the U.S. actually took over in the Philippines, there was a war, which very few people are aware of any longer today, but longer than the Vietnam War, a 14-year war, 14-year duration war with the people of the Philippines, seeking to regain the independence they thought they had won against the Spanish. And so this was a genocidal war. It was a guerrilla-type war. It was very, very brutal. It was fought with a great deal of bloodletting. And during the course of it, there was opposition in the United States, but never to the point that it was able to stop the war or force the United States government to sue for peace on grounds of independence. And so the Philippines was actually a colony of the United States from 1898, when Admiral Perry, you know, steamed into Manila Harbor, until the Japanese booted us out. And of course, you know, today people probably know about Douglas MacArthur sort of announcing, you know, "I shall return," or "I'll be back," in Arnold's parlance. But you know, people are less aware of the fact that the Philippines only gained its independence because once the Japanese left, we were no longer in a position to reclaim them. But for that period, the first half practically of the 20th century, similar with Puerto Rico as it is to this moment, it was the U.S. flag, the U.S. dollar, the U.S. postal system operating in that country.
I actually have a question about the Philippines. How much did people in the United States at that time, I mean, if the war went on for 14 years, how much did they know about it? Clearly, lots of people in the Philippines died. What about U.S. soldiers? Because I was really taken with that story and when I first heard it, because I had never heard that in school.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that we were in a war for 15 years and we killed all of these people and I'd never heard of it?
Well, it was, in terms of communication, it was an era mainly of print communication. And so what people knew, I think, was mainly either from firsthand experience or from what was being printed in the press. It was a period also of you know, some pacifism in the United States and some opposition to overseas entanglements, as they called it. But I think they were able to sell the war as this kind of civilizing struggle, that we were bringing, you know, civilization and modernity, and to portray the people fighting it as kind of peasants or worse. You know, we're back there again. I don't know if people are aware of this, but of course there is a strong Islamic presence in the Philippines. There has been armed struggle going on there for decades, actually, currently, several different forces. And the U.S. has recently committed itself to helping obliterate something called the Abu Sayyaf organization, which is a Islamic so-called terrorist group, apparently close to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's organization in the Philippines. But the Filipino government has been a kind of puppet regime since World War II, when the U.S. did come back in at the end of the war, displaced the Japanese. We were forced to grant independence because there was that wave of decolonization that did take place in the world after World War II. But the people who were put in power were people sympathetic to the United States. And so during the 50s, there was a protracted armed insurgency in the Philippines led by a group called the Huk Balapang, I think, which was essentially the communist guerrilla movement in the Philippines. And it was defeated through CIA and counterinsurgency action. Subsequent to that, in the late 60s, early 70s, a new armed struggle emerged and a popular resistance movement. And the U.S. was instrumental in bringing in the Marcos dictatorship. Marcos had been elected, but then he retained power unconstitutionally in Philippine terms for two additional terms in office. His wife, as probably people know, collected a large number of shoes. But they looted the country dramatically, you know, under this dictatorship. And there was a very, very extensive popular resistance. And also the New People's Army was a Maoist-type guerrilla organization, political organization fighting in the Philippines, which still exists. And there were significant Islamic resistance movements. People probably familiar with the whole Cory Aquino. Her husband was a liberal political figure, not exactly a revolutionary. He was assassinated. She came forward and led the sort of People's Power movement, which put through some very limited reforms. And the U.S. attempted to use that to try to crack down on other types of resistance. But in the process of bringing that government in, they did agree to close the U.S. bases in Subic Bay, which was at that time the largest U.S. naval base in the world. I think the pertinent question that you raised is, why did people let this happen? And I think that there is an ideological and a material struggle that has gone on in U.S. history about whether to have an empire, if so, on what terms, what are the costs of empire. And I think that if we look back a little further into history, I think that key question of the fact that people who have been opposed to it have refused to really look at what the nature of this society has been. And so, you know, you can go back through different periods of time when these same struggles emerged. And if you look at the Mexican-American War, another one that people tend to forget about. And I teach English as a second language in schools here in Los Angeles. A lot of my students are from Mexico. And when I ask them about it, they've actually had it obliterated from Mexican history, too. I was shocked about this because I thought that a war in which a country lost half its territory people would sort of pay more attention to. But apparently they've been told that the Santa Ana government of Mexico just sold it to the United States. But, of course, that's not what happened. It's a very similar history to what happened with Hawaii. If you look at it, Mexico became independent. In fact, this is today, I think, is the – no, tomorrow, November 20th. No, I'm sorry, that's not the independence struggle. That's the Mexican Revolution. But 1810, I believe, Mexico became independent from Spain. And when Mexico became independent, they abolished slavery, which had been in effect in Mexico under the Spanish Empire, as it had been in Canada also. But both Canada and Mexico abolished slavery well before the United States. And so Mexico did not want to have slavery on its territory. They felt that slavery was a manifestation of colonialism. Unlike the United States, in which essentially the slave owners and the settler colonists who lived off the slave system led a struggle for independence that incorporated slavery. And so there were two different social systems on this continent and this territory, and not to idealize the Mexican one because it had its own contradictions and was being led by a military dictatorship, really, of Santa Ana at that time, about two generations after the revolution. But they were interested in developing the territories of Mexico, which is the territory we're on now, was part of Mexico. All the names here, obviously, are Spanish names because it was, Los Angeles was settled under the Spanish flag, under the Spanish Empire. If you go downtown, you'll see, the little plaque and over on Olvera Street, La Placita, where they commemorate the names. And most of the people who did the settlement were actually Indians, indigenous people, and Africans, and a few conquistadors who brought them along with them to make the settlements. But when they became independent, as I say, slavery was abolished, and they tried to create a new Mexican society under more liberal or Republican ideals. And they wanted to develop the territory, which, Texas, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, the whole what's now called the U.S. Southwest was part of Mexico. And so they invited other peoples to come and settle. And they had a kind of open door immigration policy in what was then Mexico to say, well, if you come and swear allegiance, swear loyalty to Mexico and participate, in Mexican life as a Mexican, you're welcome to come. Even if you previously were not Mexican, you can become a Mexican by coming to Mexico. And so a lot of the people we've probably heard of from Walt Disney, like Davy Crockett and Sam Houston, and these various other people started migrating from the United States into Mexico. Into Texas in particular, which abutted the what later became the Confederacy, but was then was just the slave-owning South. And their goal was to expand slavery. Slavery had gotten a new lease on life in that period because of the cotton gin and because the British wanted the American cotton to batter down the Indian economy. And it was a global phenomenon even then. And they needed territory because the nature of cotton farming in particular is it really depletes the soil. And if you want to keep that going, you have to find new lands. And so they had plans to capture, even then, this is the 1840s, Cuba and some of the West Indian islands. They had delegations and sort of privateers who were trying to colonize land in Central America, had their eyes on Nicaragua and some of the other territories. And they were very, very interested in the territory of Mexico and Texas in particular. So they began to migrate from the United States to Mexico, crossing an international border and swearing allegiance to the Mexican government and, pledging to uphold the Mexican Constitution, which had abolished slavery, and then immediately beginning to agitate against the Mexican central government. Because it was, preventing them from carrying out their economic goals of development based on slavery. And so similar to what the plantation owners did in Hawaii, a couple of generations later, they began to build this movement for Texan independence and to say that the central government of Mexico is very oppressive and that they, wanted to have a more democratic system. But the basic meaning of that was they wanted to restore slavery or develop slavery in Texas. And, so one of the early propaganda issues, the whole idea of propaganda and media campaigns, these are, we remember the Alamo and we still remember the Alamo. And if you go to San Antonio, you want to go watch the Spurs or something, but you have to go see the Alamo. And, that propaganda has been, duplicated and reiterated, but it was very, very powerful then. It was like the image of a few beleaguered, American civilizers, being obliterated by like thousands of merciless savages, Mexicans who were defending their territory and their sovereignty against this upstart pro-slavery movement. And eventually the Texans were able to, with some U.S. support, to carry out this independence struggle. And they did have some Tejanos. I mean, there were Mexican people of Mexican nationality and descent who did feel that the regime of Santa Anna in Mexico City was corrupt and brutal and dictatorial, and they wanted to separate. But once it was separated, then fairly immediately they began to move for annexation. They began to ask the United States to annex that territory. And you might ask, how does this happen? Very few countries in the world really annex territory in that way. And if you look into the U.S. Constitution and how it was adopted and the whole question of the U.S. independence movement, one of the disagreements that the settlers and the founding fathers, so-called, had with the King of England was that the king had put a limit on colonization and had struck treaties with various native nations to say, okay, we will not intrude on your territories. And if you look at the Declaration of Independence, one of the main complaints against George was that he was not protecting them from the quote-unquote merciless savages. But the basis of the Constitution was that the U.S. could annex territories, and there could be territories controlled by the United States separate from the states. And so Texas wanted to be annexed on that basis, with the potential to become a state. But as a territory originally. And so as a territory, it was incorporated by the United States as a territory, which is to say a colonial holding. And then immediately a controversy erupted between the United States and Mexico about what the border was between the United States and Mexico. And Mexico, having lost this territory to the independence forces, felt that the border was defined in that struggle as a certain segment, the Rio Nueces, I think. And the United States said, oh, no, the border goes down to what we call the Rio Grande, and New Mexico is the Rio Bravo. And so, again, we precipitated an incident in which the United States sent troops in to what they knew to be an area that the Mexicans claimed, also claiming as U.S. territory. And then so then the Mexicans defended themselves, and immediately it was an issue that we had been attacked on U.S. soil by Mexico we were the aggrieved and, you know, victimized and defensive party. And so the United States launched the war against Mexico. And again, this was something that created a great deal of controversy in the United States. And some of us are familiar with parts of this history. You know, a lot of people know about Henry David Thoreau and Walden Pond and, you know, tax resistance. Thoreau was, you know, locked up in prison and or in jail for refusing to pay taxes. And I forget who it was, one of the more famous poets of the New England at that time sort of came out and to say, what are you doing in there, you know, Henry? And he said, well, no, the question is, what are you doing out there? But what very few people realize is that the taxes he was refusing to pay were the war taxes to finance this war with Mexico. And it was a hot question in the United States. And so, for example, Abraham Lincoln, who was very briefly in the Congress in his one successful electoral effort prior to becoming president, so this is 1840-something, 1846 probably, was a member of Congress from Illinois. He refused to vote for the declaration of war, which General Polk, President Polk, brought at that time. That's back when they were still making declarations of war and actually bothering to get congressional approval. But Lincoln, you know, voted against it. You could say it was an act of conscience. But the next step was to pass a budgetary allocation. And so Lincoln said, well, I have to support our boys. And I'm against the war, but I have to support our boys and our troops. I can't leave them out there without money. And so he voted for the appropriation. And that's what I'm saying about the question of the choices that people make and the struggle, what lines the people draw, and how far are they willing to stand in solidarity with other people. In that period, for example, the United States had many, many Irish immigrants coming because it was a period of time in Europe and other immigrants as well. But many, many people were fleeing various monarchical and oppressive regimes in Europe. There was a whole wave of failed democratic and republican revolutions in that same period of time. And so people were coming to this country as a place, a safe haven or for political refuge. And so many, many Irish were coming in that period of time. And, you know, there was a split and an issue facing Irish Americans. And in that struggle, some people seeking U.S. citizenship were told, well, if you join the army, you can become a citizen, something my father did, you know, later. And they were sent to Texas to fight, you know, Mexico. And they looked around and they said, wait a minute, you know, this is, the Mexicans are like we were, you know, in Ireland. I mean, they're facing this, you know, colonizing power that's taking their territory and trying to control them. There was an additional affinity because they were Catholic and Mexico is a Catholic country. And so a whole group of them, you know, changed sides. They had what they called the San Patricio Brigade. And they said, no, we're not going to fight for the United States. We're going to fight for Mexico because that's really the same fight we've been in, you know, just transplanted. So that is an option that's open to people, you know, at any time, and people can choose. And it was open to, you know, it's like Abraham Lincoln wants to retain his political viability, you know, to quote another famous president of more recent vintage, you know. And so he was prepared to vote against the declaration of war, but he was not prepared to vote against the appropriations because he thought he might be able to get back in Congress. As it turns out, I think he was defeated and then defeated again for the Senate. But what happened in the U.S. because of that? I mean, they waged that war. Another example I gave in the speech is Ulysses Grant. Ulysses Grant was, I believe, a colonel or some mid-ranking officer in the U.S. Army, and he nearly resigned his commission during the Mexican-American War because he felt it was a war of aggression and he didn't want to participate. But somebody convinced him otherwise, and he thought better of his thing. And then, of course, he retained his commission and went on to rise in the ranks and become a general eventually. President. And but again, that was a choice facing him and many of the other soldiers, not to say fight for the Mexicans necessarily, but, you know, okay, you know, do the conscientious thing and resign. And if enough ranking officers had resigned and saying it was a war of aggression, maybe more Americans would have woken up to the fact that it was not what it was being presented as in the press. But that territory was captured. And so not only Texas, but when we, you know, forced Mexico to sue for peace, it became Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, you know, parts of Colorado, California. Of course, immediately after the war, they discovered gold in California. How convenient. You know, a generation later, they discovered oil in Texas. You know, we would be living in a completely different world if this was still Mexico. you know, if the Mexicans had retained that sovereignty. And people might know about Juneteenth. Juneteenth is a black holiday in the United States. It's June 19th. It was the 3 years after the fact when the slaves in Texas discovered that the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued by Lincoln during the Civil War and that they were free. So they celebrated at that moment, which is like practically the end of the war when they learned it. But, you know, if there hadn't been slavery in Texas and if there hadn't, you know, the would have been a different course of human history, really. And that was in struggle. You know, people had choices to make at that time. But one of the results of really the Mexican-American War is, and this territory that was taken is that the whole question of slavery actually then came on the table in the United States, because the compromise that established the United States, which was to say between the North and the South, the slave-owning states and the states that relied on slave-owning but didn't have slaves themselves. And so there was the Missouri Compromise and various other compromises that were written. And basically what they said was, as they expanded, in other words, they had their eyes set on further territory. And they said, as we add new states to the Union, we're going to add, you know, a slave state and a quote unquote free state, free soil, and keep the balance. But if you look at the territory that was captured in the Mexican-American War, to the Pacific, that's entirely south of the Mason-Dixon line. And it's entirely in the South. And so the burning issue then in U.S. politics subsequent to 1848 was not about abolishing slavery, not for the political elites, but it was about the expansion of slavery. And so there was an abolitionist movement. There was a strong movement of the slaves themselves. There were some white allies who also were in favor of abolition of slavery. But the political question as it was posed within, you know, by the regime, let's say, or by the people who were allowed to govern, was should slavery be expanded or not, and how? And so, you know, Kansas, Nebraska, all that stuff that went on. But then the question of should slavery be extended to Texas, should slavery be extended to Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, California, or not, was the question that became a splitting question. And so the Republican Party, which at that time was the anti-expansion of slavery party, developed actually in California. You know, Fremont was the first candidate. He was a Californian, saying, no, we don't want slavery extended to California's territory. And then this was picked up by Lincoln, again, saying very clearly, you know, I don't care if I have to free all the slaves, no slaves. Slavery to me is not the issue. The Union is the issue. And what is the Union about? The Union is about consolidating that empire, that territory, and saying we want a single government governing this whole territory. And in fact, you know, in the middle of the Civil War, Lincoln negotiated with the Russian Empire to purchase Alaska and annex it as a territory. You know, didn't consult with the indigenous people or the Aleuts or the so-called Eskimos or, you know, but it was just a deal between the U.S. Empire, which didn't really call itself an empire, and the Russian Empire, which did. So the Union was, we have to preserve the Union. It's more important than anything else, which is the control of this single government over all of this massive land. And this process, you know, we've seen was carried out. The image of the frontier in U.S. society is this image of expansion westward, Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, you know, taking land and quote unquote civilizing it and incorporating it and running it. And so that's been a very strong dynamic. Now, that's been at war, you can say, with the other ideals and aspirations of American society, which is about democracy or, you know, limited government or you know, freedom of the individual. And the problem is that they're very wrapped up together. And so when a lot of people think about, you know, freedom of the individual, they think about something like Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett, you know, setting out for frontier land, you know, or Tomorrowland or wherever the land is, you know, and, you know, kind of taking some territory from somebody. I was just talking to somebody at work today, and a lot of our students are moving to other parts of the country, Nebraska, Oklahoma. And she said, oh, Oklahoma, you know, I'm a Sooner. And I don't know if you know the origin of that phrase, but the Sooner, you know, it was like there was a land grab. You're probably familiar with that general image of Oklahoma was native territory. You know, when they pushed, when Jackson, who was the great Democrat, you know, his democracy is based on yeoman farmers and white supremacy, very, very conscious. He was a slave owner himself, and particularly he was an Indian killer. And so Jackson had sent troops into Florida when it was still part of the Spanish Empire, without even government authorization to try to force the Spanish to turn Florida over to the United States. When he became president, he launched the Trail of Tears, driving the Cherokee out of the Southeast. They were a settled population. They had a written language. They had, you know, passed. They had accommodated themselves to sort of Westernization and Europeanization, and, you know, had cities and farms and property lines, and were willing to live in that system. And they were told they had to leave and clear out. And the Supreme Court ruled that Jackson had no authority to do that, and that it was a violation of several previously existing treaties, which were the highest law of the land. And Jackson said, well, how many troops does the Supreme Court have? Pretty much out there. And, you know, proceeded to carry out the, you know, this sort of exterminationist policy, ethnic cleansing, moving people out. And so they moved them to Oklahoma. Then, of course, they discovered that there were things they wanted in Oklahoma, including the land and the oil. And in the wake of the Civil War, the United States established all these land-grant colleges and various other mechanisms, and said, well, we want to settle this territory. And the Sooners, to go back to that point, were the people who jumped the gun. In other words, did you see that movie with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, the first one, not the subsequent one, but they did a movie, Far and Away, something like that. Yeah. He's like an Irish guy, and she's like a, he's shanty Irish, and she's, you know, upper class, and they keep bumping into each other on their way into America. And then her parents are Sooners. They're the people who, like, left before they were supposed to get land sooner than the other people who were just stealing it with government authority.
Let me back you up for a second. You were talking about Jackson's kind of actions contradicting the Supreme Court. What was Congress doing at this time?
Congress was probably in his corner. I mean, he had come in, you know, as a kind of reformer. I mean, if you know the whole thing about Jacksonian democracy, it was like, let's open up the franchise. Let's get more, you know, let's not restrict it only to property holders. So as he came in and his coalition came to power, he had, you know, a great deal of congressional support, because there were a lot of new congressional seats and offices up and open, and he had a mass base of frontiersmen and, you know, lower working class and you know, small farmers who were interested in that land and interested in, you know, pursuing that strategy.
So there's popular support.
So he had, and reflected then in congressional support. But it is one of the, you know, if you go through the textbooks of, like, key Supreme Court decisions, that's one that stands out there as was unenforceable. It was, you know, like Stalin used to say about the Pope or something, how many divisions does he have, you know? And anyway, the question, you know, in the wake of the Civil War, well, leading up to the Civil War, was this question of expansion and the expansion of slavery. And so, you know, the war was eventually fought, and because of the actions of the slaves, you know, slavery was abolished as part of the process of the war. Again, had imperial connections. The British Empire was looking around, trying to see what to do. They had a lot of ties to the South because of the cotton growing, and so Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in the middle of the war was designed to, you know, sort of win international favor and put a patina on the war, that it was, you know, a war for sort of human dignity and so on. But then the struggle reemerges after the war. What happens with the slaves, the so-called freedmen, and you know, a lot of struggle in U.S. society about that, and including among African Americans. And I want to be clear. I mean, I'm an anti-white supremacist, but I don't think it's something that is inherent in white people. I mean, I think this same struggle then emerged among Black people about what to do, how to relate to this society. And, you know, the period after the Civil War, you see the whole phenomenon of Buffalo Soldiers, for example, which is African Americans saying, being told, well, okay, you can be incorporated into our society too, just help us settle the West, you know, go fight the Indians for us. And, you know, people do that. And not only African Americans obviously did that, but because it was the U.S. cavalry. But, you know, having captured the territory from Mexico, then the whole center of the U.S. was really at war for, you know, a couple of decades until they could resolve you know, between the 1860s and the 1880s until they could finally conquer and settle that question of native sovereignty inside. And so, and again, you know, what did people think about Sitting Bull at the time? And there were, you know, struggles and controversies. You know, there's a T-shirt around now sort of says, my heroes have always killed cowboys. I don't know if you've seen that one. But, of course, it wasn't cowboys that the Indians were killing. I mean, we call it cowboys and Indians, but it was the cavalry. And the cavalry is not the cowboy. The cavalry is the army. And they were fighting, you know, a war for their survival as a people. And again, if you look at that history, you know, what happened, you know, Lincoln came in and they began to push the Transcontinental Railroad and they, you know, they industrialized. They said they drove the Golden Spike, you know, and they killed all the bison. You know, once you put the trains through there across the plains, you've got to transform the whole economy and ecology of the plains. And the native people lived on the bison, you know. In a very respectful way. I mean, they weren't exterminating the bison, but they were living with and among, it was, you know, there was an economy and an ecology based on the idea that there were these giant grazing animals, you know, living on huge grasslands. And, you know, there was no economic advantage in riding along on a train, shooting out the window and killing every bison you saw, except that you knew it was going to destroy the native population that was based on that. And so that's the domestic empire. You know, it's been cobbled together over and over again in the same way. And it was based on some very racist doctrines, the doctrine of manifest destiny, which is, you know, written over and over again in U.S. history. But it was the idea that sort of these Europeans on the Atlantic coast had the almost the moral responsibility or God-given mandate to march across to the Pacific coast and beyond, certainly, because Alaska and Hawaii and all the other ideas were beyond that. And so that's the kind of dynamic, as I say, that has been at war with the other aspects of the politics and the other aspects of the belief system. And I think the question that's facing us is that, you know, we need to look at how deeply rooted, you know, that side of it is to really understand how to uproot it. Because if you don't recognize really what the problem is, then you can't really solve it. If you look at efforts to deal with the race question in the United States, you know, this is what, 40, 50 years now, almost after the civil rights movement began, certainly. We're in the 21st century, and yet the problem keeps repeating and reappearing and manifesting itself. And I think that's because people don't want to recognize that it's connected to this question of colonialism and colonization and a denial of self-determination for the, you know, people, African people in this continent, and that is connected to the nature of the state as a whole. It's not just something that you can somehow tweak and improve and, you know, grant people equivalent status. You know, it's got to be something that comes from a transformation of the whole thing.
Can I jump forward into present day? Mm-hmm. You talk about colonization and self-determination, and we're looking at a circumstance in the Middle East where this country has taken some rather serious, aggressive action towards a people under the auspices of, I guess, as it's stated, to stop terrorism. But there seems to be a larger agenda at play, which I think falls into the areas that you started to describe. How would you articulate a view towards the implications, the colonial implications, mm-hmm. the lack of self-determination implications for our actions today?
It's a very good question. I think that, you know, one of the issues that's at play here is that the United States has always been very, very effective at presenting itself as doing one thing while it does something else. And I think that's what you see in this whole history, that we're always putting ourselves forward as the liberators. And, you know, in this context as well, I mean, people say, well, how did the Taliban topple so fast? And, you know, I think we have to understand that they were an extremely dictatorial and repressive regime that did not have a base in Afghani society, really, even. And so the United States was primed to, like, come in and say, well, we are your liberators. You know, we're going to come bomb the spit out of you and, but, you know, present ourselves in the same way. Well, we're here, you know, in support of the Afghani people. And what it's important to understand is that there's a lot more going on than just the question of terrorism, because if you look back, again, not to get too historical, but the more recent history is of the Kosovo War. What happened there? You know, we had this Cold War that went on for years and years and years and years, And then apparently we won, or anyway, the Soviet Union collapsed. People started saying, where's the peace dividend? You know, all this stuff. What are we doing? And somehow it wasn't there. But what happened was that the United States began to expand NATO into what had been the Warsaw Pact. And if you look at that for a minute and think about it, what was it directed at, and what happened in that whole war in Kosovo? And in that war, the United States was sort of allying itself with Muslims, both in Bosnia and Herzegovina and then in Kosovo with the, you know, sort of ethnic Albanians, which is Albania is an Islamic country, in Kosovo were Muslims inside. You know, that whole territory is an area that was under you know, different imperial regimes. If you go back to, you know, the when people talk about Balkanization on the Balkans, you know, what they're talking about is that the, you know, the Russian Empire, the Austrian Empire, the Ottoman Empire were all competing and contesting with each other in that territory. And those empires collapsed, you know, in World War One. I mean, Osama bin Laden's grievance was that the Ottoman Empire, which had been a singular state embracing most of the Muslim world under a single regime, you know, had been broken up and smashed. I mean, they lost World War One. They were on the wrong side of that battle, and they were a somewhat decrepit regime again. And so the Western powers moved in, carved it up in different ways. But we're more familiar with how it was carved up in, you know, with Syria and Lebanon and Palestine and so on. The British, you know, had this mandate on Palestine to give the Jews a place to live and so on. But the same thing would happen in Europe over the course of those empires, and the populations were intermixed. So the United States moved into that, you know, in the recent period. The whole question of what is Europe was up for grabs, up, and you know, is Europe going to be at peace? Is Europe unifying under the European Union? What's going to happen to the former Soviet Union, the former Soviet republics? You know, the Soviet Union had consolidated a hold over the old Russian Empire, and so as the Soviet Union collapsed, what happened is that all the societies that had been contained and suppressed within that Soviet Empire, built on the Russian Empire, came free and came loose. And that's very threatening to imperialism. If you have a power vacuum, if you have societies breaking free, and so you see all the stands, right? Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and, you know, the struggle between the Armenians and the Azeris and Azerbaijan and so on and so forth. All of that is very, very threatening to empires, because empires want to have stability and domination. And so the United States was looking at that and trying to understand how to project its forces into that area in such a way that they could do with the Russian Empire what they had done with the Spanish Empire. In other words, if as that empire crumbled, they had to find a way to militarily and politically intervene and begin to dominate those territories. And the Europeans also are looking at a contest and a question and a struggle. And so Kosovo represented, again, a war that had a lot more going on than what was said on the surface. The United States in that war presented itself as somehow being, you know, sort of allied with the poor, oppressed Kosovars against...
Liberatory.
The liberator of the Kosovars against the dictatorial Milosevic regime. And, you know, Milosevic was in the way for a lot of plans. And I'm not defending Milosevic at all, because I think that he was dictatorial, and he was part and parcel of the attempt to break up the old Yugoslavia by fomenting ethnic rivalries and nationalism. But he was also an obstacle. And I think this is a period of time in which you, you know, one of the things you see is a lot of what's been called warlordism. In the absence of really true movements and philosophies, ideologies of liberation, you find people, you know, as these empires are contending and disintegrating, people trying to carve out pieces of it for themselves under power. And so there's Milosevic. But the U.S. has its longer view, saying we want to move through the Balkans to the Caspian, and through the Caspian into these republics of South and Central Asia that have broken free from imperialism because the Soviet Empire has collapsed. We have to try to redominate them. And so NATO was transformed in that war into an aggressive military alliance. And, you know, nobody can deny that. I mean, NATO had been defined as a defensive alliance against the Warsaw Pact to defend Western Europe against possible attack from Eastern Europe. And then their enemy disappears, and instead of dissolving themselves, they absorb some of those nation states and say, no, become part of our military alliance, and we will direct our forces eastward. We'll have a footprint. And that's what Kosovo was. And saying we're going to plant ourselves here, but we're looking east. We're looking at, you know, Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan and Afghanistan. And we're looking at the Caspian and the Central Asian oil resources and trying to figure out how to get them, how to control them, how to make sure that they don't become independent of imperial control. That they don't fall maybe to the Iranians or some other forces.
Let me just throw a loop in here. How does Putin fall into the notion of imperial control in present day? He seems to be tactically aligning himself with Western economic interests. It seems that way. Would you say that's true? And if it's true, is that just – is he – what I get, and I hate to ramble here, but what I get is that you're describing these various warlords as really protectionist forces. And our interest in dissolving those, as it were, and creating a broader agreement is for markets, right? And how does Putin fall into that? And is that part of our imperialist doctrine?
Well, I would say it's for markets and resources. I don't think we necessarily want to dissolve the warlords. I think that we want to find ones that are malleable and maintain their position under our control. You know, if you look at a lot of these figures, Milosevic was somebody who worked with the U.S. at a point when the U.S. had an interest going back to very early on, the first Bush regime, you know, set out this policy of breaking up, Yugoslavia, and specifically wrote its economic policies that they would, rather than giving economic aid or the IMF writing loans to Yugoslavia, they would write loans to the different republics based on how open those republics were to austerity measures or to integration into the Western economy. And so Milosevic was part and parcel of that, along with Tudjman and some of the others who were, you know, people coming out of the old communist regime, but now striking nationalist postures. And they were fine as warlords if they were part of the program. The same way with, Somalia or Osama bin Laden, for that matter, or the Taliban. They were fine as warlords as long as they were dancing to the U.S. tune. And Osama bin Laden was working with the U.S. Quite recently, on this whole thing. I mean, his forces were on our side in the Kosovo War, and his forces were, in Bosnia-Herzegovina on the side that we backed and so on. So it's not that the U.S. is opposing these warlords, but they just want to make sure they maintain some domination. That's what you see now with the Northern Alliance. Those are the warlords backed by Russia as a great power, quite apart from any ideological thing that the old Soviet intervention, and Iran backing some of them, and so the U.S. now is, you know, not opposed to warlordism, but just wants to make sure that those warlords kind of toe the line and follow the program. So Putin, you know, is somebody who was anointed president of Russia. He came out of the KGB. He was plucked by who's that old drunk? Yeltsin. He was plucked by Yeltsin, thank you, for to be essentially acting president, and then, you know, ran for president and was elected. But he's not somebody who represented any liberation struggle or anything like that in Russia. And so the current Russian regime is basically, you know, regime that was created by the West, for other purposes. I think I think they did think at one point that they could develop Russia, but it became really a gangster capitalist state. He's doing a little bit of reform now against a few, oligarchs that maybe don't fall into his camp, but it's not against the oligarchy in general. It's just that, you know, there's always infighting that goes on among those people. And what they basically did was loot, Russia and loot all that, they privatized all that public and social wealth, and in the process impoverished. You know, I mean, the life expectancy in Russia has, you know, dropped 10 or 15 years since the capitalism was restored.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Novick, author of White Lies, White Power, on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is on Welcome Guests. The interview continues.